In January 2025, the world watched in disbelief as extremely catastrophic wildfires impacted Los Angeles. This episode of the GeoTrek podcast addresses the topic of wildfire mitigation to help individuals and communities reduce the risk from this high-impact catastrophe. Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast, where we tell stories of extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. On the podcast, we focus on the physical processes behind extreme events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of such events to reduce the loss of life and property. Whether you're tuning in on the road, at home, or out on the trail, each episode of the GeoTrek podcast brings you exciting insights and actionable stories that bring you closer to the forces shaping our planet. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and join the conversation on your favorite listening platform. In episode 107 of the GeoTrek podcast, we analyze the devastating January 2025 wildfires in Southern California and discuss how communities can better prepare for future wildfire threats. Our special guest, Steve Hawks, Senior Director for Wildfire at IBHS and former CAL FIRE Battalion Chief, brings decades of expertise in wildland firefighting and fire prevention. Having been deployed to the LA fires, he shares firsthand insights into wildfire behavior, risk mitigation, and the importance of building resilience. Steve, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
Steve, we're talking about building better to mitigate wildfires. So how is this hazard of a wildfire different than a house fire?
Yeah, when you have a house fire, it's at a small location and it's easy access for the fire suppression resources to respond into. They all go to that same location. And generally, the house fire is contained to the room that the fire starts in or the building that it starts in. Sometimes, you know, when you have wind with that fire, the fire can get out of the windows or openings in the structure and affect some structures that are nearby. But generally, it's contained to a few structures in that instance as well. When you have a wildfire, it starts out in grass, brush, or timber areas. And then, and sometimes it's really remote areas and hard for the fire suppression resources. It takes them a while to get to that location. And as they're responding, the fire's continuing to grow. And when you add wind into it, it could really make the fire grow quickly. And the fire suppression resources aren't able to focus on one particular location of the fire like they are in a house fire. So they have to spread out and attack all areas of the fire. And then I'll take it one step further. When a wildfire burns into an urban environment, it really stops being a wildfire at that point and becomes an urban conflagration when it starts to involve structures and spread through structure-to-structure fire spread. That urban conflagration, it's burning urban fuels, structures, outbuildings, vehicles, boats, fences, anything that you have on your property that's combustible, the fire can burn that, which contributes to the spread of the fire through the community.
Well, Steve, that's really interesting. And that makes me think, I would imagine you'd have a lot more range of types of fuels and types of things that can burn once it's an urban fire compared to when it was a wildfire. Would that be correct?
Yes, and the tactics are slightly different. On a wildfire, the firefighters are able to focus on the fire line where the active fire front is at, and really use their tools to remove the fuel within the path of the fire to create a fuel break to stop the forward spread of the fire. When it's in an urban environment, you can't bulldoze houses down and dig trenches in through the brush. So it's a much different environment from a firefighting perspective.
Well, that's really interesting. Like you're saying, if you're out in the brush, you can kind of manipulate that landscape to give you an advantage. Maybe it's a lot harder to do that if you're in an urban environment, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then you throw in on these high wind situations, the ability of the fire to, when it's igniting structures, develop embers. And then those embers get lofted into the air and they travel downwind. And when they deposit themselves onto something combustible, they can create spot fires and ignite new fires. And when that's on a home, it can ignite the home directly, or it could ignite vegetation and other combustible items near the home, which in turn, those items then could ignite the house. So it's a much different environment.
Steve, hazard scientists often talk about the geography of hazards, right? Like theoretically, a tornado could hit any community in the country, but we know some areas are more likely to get a tornado strike than others. Let's talk about the geography of wildfires. Where are these wildfires most likely to happen? What types of setups or factors do we think about?
Yeah, certainly across the U.S., there are areas that are more prone to wildfires, and that's generally considered to be the western states. And when you look at the hazard from a wildfire, you look at the things that influence fire behavior the most, the fuel that the fire would burn in, the weather that influences the fire behavior, the topography that can make a fire burn fast uphill, and so forth, and fire history as well. But conflagrations really follow three main factors, and that's drought, and when drought occurs at any scale, when you have a strong wind or high wind component that accompanies that, and then you have people. And people are two things. They lead to 90 to 95% of all ignitions of wildfires. And then when the fire starts and it burns into the neighborhoods and communities, and we start to have homes impacted, then that's where the recipe, those three factors, drought, wind, and developed communities really come into play of setting the stage for a conflagration to ensue.
Steve, sometimes I've heard people say they're especially concerned when a drought is preceded by maybe a year or, you know, a season of wet weather where you may see a lot of vegetation growth followed by a drought. I mean, do hazard scientists really look at that as far as, like, say, available fuels as well that are maybe drying out?
Certainly, yes. When you have a really wet winter, you get really good growth on vegetation. Grass becomes very tall. The brush puts on a lot of growth as well as trees. And then when you follow that by a drought year, then you just have more fuel that's available for the fire to start and burn in. And again, once that fire then hits the community, it really transitions from being a wildfire to an urban fire, burning in those urban fuels. But that helps set the stage for the fire to get from its ignition point into the community.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Steve, we were heartbroken to see these catastrophic wildfires in Los Angeles recently. I know you and your team spent some time there really on the ground and just seeing this firsthand. We know there are thousands of wildfires, mostly small ones around the U.S. each year. I mean, what factors led those L.A. wildfires to be such a high profile and high impact event?
Yeah, and first, our hearts go out to everyone who's been impacted by these terrible fires. We hope for a speedy recovery for everyone involved. But it really comes down to those three factors that I mentioned, the drought conditions, the wind, and then a community or people. And then when you have an ignition and the fire burns quickly into the environment, there's three additional factors that lead to how easy it is for the fire to spread from structure to structure or through the community. And those three factors are the spacing of homes, how closely spaced are homes from each other, the connectivity of fuels between structures. So if one structure ignites, will it then ignite a shed, which in turn ignites a fence, and then that fence connects directly to the next house, and that fire burns along the fence and ignites the next house in line. So that connectivity of fuels that provide a pathway for the fire to travel. And then the last component is the materials that the home is made out of. If they're more vulnerable to wildfire, then there's a higher chance of the home igniting versus other materials that are less vulnerable. And of all the fires that we have, less than 1% of them lead to over 95% of the total structure loss from wildfires. And so it's under very small conditions where these three things line, drought, wind, and people align with the start that's next to a community that quickly forces the fire into the community. And it really doesn't matter at that point if you're considered to have been in a higher fire threat area versus a lower fire threat area. When you have a fire that starts underneath these conditions, that can quickly become a conflagration in any fire threat area.
Did you find, Steve, a lot of people just shocked at the timing of this fire? I mean, we picture Southern California typically under a Mediterranean climate with cool, wet winters, long, dry summers. But we saw this tremendous wildfire catastrophe in January where we typically would think of cooler, wetter weather. I mean, did that shock a lot of people? Did that even maybe play into just our ability to respond to it because it happened at an unusual time of the year?
Well, it is not your typical time of the year, but we have really changed our messaging around wildfires as not being a seasonal event. It can happen throughout the entire year when these conditions of drought, wind, and communities come together, which is the exact scenario that unfolded in Southern California.
Yeah, Steve, that makes sense. I mean, once you have those three factors, you're going to get a wildfire, right? It's almost like we talk about hurricane season. The beginning of hurricane season is June 1st. There's not something in physics that says now it's June 1st, you can have a hurricane, right? It's just bringing together all those factors. And once they align, you can definitely get that hazard.
Yes, well, absolutely.
Steve, excited to bring up one of our favorite segments of the show called Weathered Wisdom. So this is a recurring segment where we ask every guest to share a story or lesson they've learned from weather that's left a lasting impression, whether it's a moment of survival, discovery, or reflection. So this could be something that's impacted you professionally or personally, just a weather story that really sticks out to you and maybe that really influenced you. So Steve, what's your weathered wisdom?
Yes, mine involves the campfire, which was the fire that started near the town of Polga, California, and burned quickly into the town of Paradise, virtually destroying the town of Paradise in 2018. I grew up in the town of Paradise. My parents still live there in the house that I grew up in. The day of the fire, they lost their house. And I knew a number of other friends that I grew up with going to school who lived in Paradise, their families, who lost their homes as well. And so that really drove me to, want to continue my career then with the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, or CAL FIRE, to help communities prepare for these potential devastating events. And upon my retirement, I had the great opportunity to join the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, IBHS, to continue that work.
Steve, how was that different for you to spend time and work in a fire zone where you had so many personal connections? I mean, did that feel different to you?
Absolutely. That was the only time in my career as a firefighter with CAL FIRE that I can say a fire was personal to me. All the others, you go to the fire, you do what you're there to do, you leave and go on to the next incident. This one was personal with, my family, my parents losing their house, and other friends losing their homes and stuff. So and as I mentioned, it's kind of what propelled me to continue doing this type of work post my career with CAL FIRE.
Yeah, Steve, I love how you took that impact on your personal life, and then you helped to, redirect how you want to make a bigger impact and help mitigate and help educate people to help prevent the loss of wildfire. I love how you turned that into something where you can make a difference. That's really commendable.
Yeah, thank you.
Steve, I wanted to talk to you about, mitigation. I mean, we've covered so far in the podcast what a wildfire is, and the geography and the conditions that, environmentally, what's going to set off these wildfires and help them grow. But what I love that you and your team are doing at IBHS is you're helping educate and prepare people that there are choices they can make as a community. There are choices they can make as individuals to better prepare their communities and their property for wildfires. There's a bunch of things we're going to talk about here. And Jeremiah Long, our senior video producer, is here on the podcast as well to pop up some of these pictures and graphics that we can walk through. I wanted to start by asking, really, how can we reduce the risk of wildfire impacts starting at the parcel and the property level? We're not even talking about the structure yet, but just the property itself. What are some things that people can do?
Yeah, so at the property, it's really defined as the defensible space. And so it's about reducing the reducing the exposure to the house. And so you do that by either removing things off the property. So for example, I mentioned earlier, a shed might play into the fire's ability to spread to the house. So you remove the shed off the property altogether if you can. That that way it won't burn or ignite and potentially lead to the ignition of the home. You can relocate items. So that same shed, you can relocate it a different spot on the property if you have the space to do that. And that way, if it ignites, it can safely burn itself out and not lead to the ignition of the home. Or you can make those items more resilient themselves and reduce their flammability. So you can, same as you can with the home, use better fire-resistant building materials to reduce the likelihood that that structure, that outbuilding would ignite and lead to the loss of the house. So it's really about reducing the exposure.
Yeah, Steve, that's fascinating. And it sounds like something that a lot of people could do, just thinking how they're setting up their property. I wanted to ask you, when you're talking about a shed, or I'm thinking about a garage or an outbuilding, should people be thinking about the contents of that as well? Like with, say, lighter fuel or gasoline or some of these chemicals that people may store on their property, how should they think about that in terms of just having those things, you know, on the property itself?
Right. So that really gets to the second component of property level risk reduction. And we think of this as a coupled approach that looks to reduce the exposure, which I just talked about, through removing, reducing, or relocating things on the property. And but we know that we can't fully reduce the exposure to the house. There's still going to be things that are there that ignite and will expose the house to direct flame contact, radiant heat, and embers. And so then it gets down to the house. What are the exterior components? And that's what we focus on, is the exterior of the home. What are those components made out of? The materials and also the design of the structure can play into it too. And how do we make those components more resilient to be able to withstand those remaining items on the property that could ignite and expose the home to the fire? And so we look at the roof and start at the roof line. And then, which is the most vulnerable component, it's a large surface area, sits high up off the ground. Sometimes it has very complex shapes to it and can tend to harbor debris from wind, as well as embers blow in there and find that debris and ignite it. And unfortunately, over 99% of homes already have a Class A fire rated roof, which is the highest fire rating for a roof. And then you work your way down to the gutters and the eaves and siding and windows and all the components of the home to the ground.
So that's interesting. It sounds like a very systematic approach, that you're starting maybe with the roof, you're working down and you're looking at every component of that house and how it could mitigate wildfire.
Yeah, all components of the house. That's how I typically approach it, is starting at the roof and working to the ground. And then you do that on each side of the house. So you do that in the front, then you go to the side, back, and the other side, and repeat the process and look at all those vulnerabilities. In some instances, it's not the big thing that you might think that could lead to the loss of a home. It could be a very minor a thing that you seemingly may not recognize as a vulnerability in the structure, but yet it is. And that could be for an open eave, as an example, where you have the freeze blocking that goes between the rafters that stick out on the eave. If the freeze blocking doesn't abut up against the rafter tails tightly and leaves over an eighth of an inch gap, embers can flow through that space into the attic behind it with enough energy to ignite something on the other side. And then you have a fire starting on the inside of the house. So it's not always the more obvious thing. Sometimes it's the little things that you may not recognize.
Well, that's really interesting. It seems like there's a lot of science to how this plays out. Like you said, with the flames reaching the home, with embers coming in from a distance, and all these things, it sounds like, are considered. What about, Steve, like the actual building materials? I mean, are there some materials, say shingles or siding, that are more fire resistant than others? I mean, how should we think about that?
Yes. And I mentioned already for the roof, the Class A roof, there's Class B and C. Class A provides the highest level of protection and is what you want to have for roof, either by material or a system on your roof. Then you get go to each component. So for gutters, if you have them on your home, it could be either vinyl or metal. Vinyl will melt and drop fire expose the fascia board potentially to the remaining heat from the fire and embers, exposing that fascia board. And it drops fire to the ground as well, putting fire right at the base of the house. So we really want to make sure that we're using non-combustible or metal gutters in that instance. And so you look at each component like that. For siding is one that you have a number of options typically for. And the siding could be ignition-resistant materials or non-combustible. Ignition-resistant, like the term implies, it resists igniting, but once it does ignite, it can spread fire on the wall to other more vulnerable components like the eaves, vents, windows, and so forth. So, you know, it's really best to have non-combustible siding that won't ignite at all and allow for the fire to spread to those other vulnerable components.
Steve, you're sharing about some pretty complex science here. So like, how do fire scientists know this? Like, how do you know that certain materials will do better than others? Or are we, you know, looking at a lot of like on the ground field surveys after a fire? Or, you know, could you talk to us as well about field testing materials in labs, things like that? Like, how do you at IBHS know what works and what doesn't?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a team of wildfire scientists that conduct research on the building as a system of components. So at our research center in Richburg, South Carolina, we have a laboratory with a bank of 105 fans that are 6 feet in diameter that can collectively blow up to 135 mile an hour wind. And then in the big six-story concrete test chamber behind it, we have a turntable on it, and we can build a full-size structure and place that structure on the turntable, and then we can expose that structure as all of the components together to ember exposure, simulated ember exposure from a wildfire, and cast those embers onto the structure from the bank of fans that we have, and see how the structural components, the materials that they're made out of, and also typically, we do our research that encompasses that first 5 feet of defensible space, which I didn't mention earlier, but and I was remiss in doing that. And I should mention it now that first 5 feet for defensible space is just so critical that it's where embers can land or even a fire advancing on the property can burn through that zone. And even a small fire has the ability to ignite a vulnerable component when it's right up against the structure. And so we at our research center, we have the ability to test the buildings as a system of components, which is how we explain wildfire mitigation, especially under these 1% of fires that lead to the over the 95% of loss, that it's under these high intensity wildfires that you have to prepare your home against that type of wildfire. And so it's all the components of the structure and its immediate surroundings that give that home, when all those things are done, give the home the best chance of surviving the wildfire.
Steve, that's amazing. So you can essentially simulate real world conditions in the IBHS lab in South Carolina. And it sounds like you're trying to make this as realistic as you can. You have fans, you have embers, you have these different construction materials. Does something stand out to you, like something you learned in the lab that you were like, wow, I wouldn't have necessarily, you know, thought of this, but it just, you know, lab testing allows us to tweak different conditions, and sometimes we get insights that we wouldn't have gained other ways.
Yeah, I think for me, it's that two things here. It's the system of components that you have to do, you know, really defend every component of the structure and the immediate surroundings to give the house the best chance of survival. And then the last one is that first 5 feet that surrounds the house. Based on the research that we've done and really been able to field validate on the post-fire field deployments that we've had, and most recently on the LA wildfires, we see just how critical having combustible items in that area can be ignited by embers or direct flame contact, which in turn then could ignite the house and lead to the loss. So that first 5 feet is so critical to defend a home from wildfire.
Steve, you're talking about the importance of this 5 feet of defensible space, and you've also talked about different building designs, different materials that can help mitigate fire. I mean, do we see communities and wildfire-prone places adapting this, having some kind of zoning or building code, like saying, okay, we're going to enforce these types of things, or is that not really something that we really see in practice?
So wildfire mitigation really needs to be done community-wide to give the community the best chance of survival. Wildfire is unlike other perils, where when you begin to ignite homes, it can actually make the wildfire or the urban fire at that point stronger and allow it to fuel it, so to speak, to spread through the community, unlike other perils. If a wind blows off a house, it doesn't make the hurricane stronger. So yes, building codes play a critical role in this, and they really focus around new construction. They don't address the existing housing stock that's out there, but we don't want the new homes to contribute, in the future to this problem. We want them to be really wildfire resilient. And so there's codes out there like the International Code Council's International Wildland Urban Interface Code. There's the National Fire Protection Association's Standard 1140. And then states can produce their statewide code. In California, it's the California Building Code Chapter 7A. And other states are working on developing their version of a code like that. Oregon and Colorado are a couple of them. Utah also already has a statewide code. But we found from some research that we did with NFPA, the National Fire Protection Association, and Verisk Analytics, that statewide code adoption across the states for wildfire is very limited. And even down at the community or county level is very limited. And codes are not always found in the same location. In California, you have the California Building Code Chapter 7A, which deals with the building itself. But for the defensible space, that's an entirely different code. And so sometimes it can be difficult to track, where to find that information and how to implement that.
Yeah, Steve, that's really interesting. It sounds like communities are at least talking about this. It sounds like there's an awareness of steps that can be taken. And I think that's a really interesting point you made, that if my neighbor's house gets hit by a tornado or a hurricane, that doesn't make the storm worse. You're saying in wildfire, what my neighbors are doing and what others in the community are doing could actually affect my house.
Absolutely, yeah. If you have a house that ignites and you have that connectivity of fuels between them, or they're close together, one house burning can easily ignite the next house. So everything that ignites can produce embers, heat, and flames that just continues the spread of the fire and adds to its intensity as it burns through the community. So it's really critical we not only address the property level mitigation, each home, but we also address community-wide mitigation, which a big component of that is each individual property doing their part. It just needs to be done at scale. And then addressing the other components that fall outside of the individual properties, like the fuel that abuts the community or is, maybe an open space within a community, so that we can break up that pathways for the fire to travel.
Steve, with GeoTrek, we're constantly trying to go out into disaster zones to see what we can learn on the ground. Several years ago, I did my first wildfire chase, if you want to call it that. I was documenting a wildfire in Carbon, Texas. I was driving down the street the day after the fire, and I just saw home after home just completely burned down, except for this one house was not touched. And a lady was there. I went up and just said, I'm just curious, what's different about your home? And she shared this story. She said the morning that the fire came through, about 3 hours before the fire arrived, she basically had a company come out and do plumbing work, and they used a back-end loader or front-end loader to basically dig up the one side of her house. So they basically had to get to piping. They used machinery, and essentially it created a defensible space. She wasn't even thinking of this intentionally, but this company came in, they dug up the plumbing, and there was about a 15-foot strip of dirt along the side of her house where the fire approached. And essentially it created a defensible space. But what stands out to me in this story was When the fire arrived, it found 15 feet of dirt on the side of her house where the fire was approaching, and that saved her house. It's a question I have, like, when we talk about defensible space, should it even get down to the level of maybe avoiding grass? Like, have you heard of communities say, hey, let's have rock landscaping or patios or things like that, where we're even taking away the grass? Or is that, you know, getting too minute of a perspective?
Certainly within that first 5 feet, we want it to be non-combustible. So anything that can burn in there, wood mulch, plants, grass, artificial turf, anything in that area has the potential to ignite and allow the fire to get to the house. And that's where you want to start, is that first 5 feet, and then go out from there. When you hit to the next zone for defensible space, which is the 5 to 30 foot area out from the house, you can start introducing lawns, wood mulch, plants. You just need to be smart about where you place them and how you separate them, both providing for horizontal separation between two plants so that if one ignites, it doesn't then ignite the next one and the next one and get to the house. Both vertical and horizontal separation between plants and trees. Don't put higher or larger combustibles that if they were to ignite close to the home, because then that could lead to very high radiant heat and potential for direct flame contact on the home. Put them further away from the house. So that's that component that we talked about earlier of reducing the exposure to the house.
Steve, that's really helping us. You're giving us some specifics of what this defensible space should look like. You know, when we first started talking, I wasn't sure if that includes even grasses and mulch. It sounds like you're saying it's not just getting a big tree away from the side of your house. It's really anything that can burn.
Yeah, any combustible has the ability to ignite and then lead to more embers, more radiant heat, and direct flame contact exposure to the house. So try to, first 5 feet, nothing combustible. As you go further away from the house, you can start introducing things, just create good separation between them. We don't want that connectivity of fuels for the fire to travel through different combustible objects directly to the house.
Yeah, fantastic. Steve, I'm learning a lot here. I know our listeners are going to love this episode. What I love about it is the work that you and IBHS are doing are empowering people that you can't necessarily stop the wildfire from forming on the mountainside behind your community, but there are things you can do as an individual in a community to reduce that risk. Steve, how can our listeners find you, your team, the work you're doing? We'd love to follow and continue to see what you're doing in your research and your field work.
Absolutely. We have two websites, IBHS.org. You can go there to find more information about all the perils that we research around. That's wind, wind-driven rain, hail, and wildfire. And then you can go to wildfireprepared.org, and we have developed a program called Wildfire Prepared Home that outlines all of the really that systems-based approach to wildfire mitigation at the property level, looking at how we increase the resilience of the house while simultaneously reducing the exposure from combustible items that could ignite near the house. And we offer a designation currently in two states, California and Oregon. If you're a single family homeowner there with a home up to three stories in height, you could take these mitigation actions and apply on our website for a designation and go through that process.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm sure our listeners are going to look into those resources and again, be empowered by the work that you and your team are doing. Steve, as we wrap up this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, what's one last message you'd like to share with our listeners?
There's hope. You don't have to feel hopeless against these wildfires. There is absolutely things that we know that work, that are based in science, that we've, IBHS and other research organizations have done a lot of research around. We've been able to field validate them during our post-disaster field deployments. We know these things work. It's that systems-based approach to wildfire mitigation of the home and its immediate surroundings. And if you take a look at your house, because each house and its immediate surroundings is different, figure out what vulnerabilities you have, and then develop a plan and start prioritizing what can I do now, what is some things that I can do as a DIY project versus someone project that I might have to hire somebody to do, and start developing a plan and working towards getting to that all of those items that you have on your checklist checked off.
Steve, thanks so much for sharing those insights, the work that you and your team are doing. And I think it's going to benefit our listeners to really help them mitigate their risk for wildfire loss. Thank you so much for taking time to come in the podcast, Steve. And best wishes to you and your team moving forward with your research.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Hal.
I got two major action points from this episode with Steve. Number one is Steve really provided a message of hope, focusing on homeowners creating defensible space around their homes, thinking about the design of a home to mitigate wildfire, but also looking at materials that are more fire resistant. Number two, I really got from Steve this concept that although wildfires may be more common in certain parts of the year than others, there's not necessarily a defined wildfire season. And these fires in Los Angeles that were in January, you know, it's not what we typically would think of as wildfire season, but they still happened. And we have to always be prepared for natural disasters. Sometimes we see disasters happening at a time of the year where we wouldn't normally expect it. Another example of this is the Mayfield, Kentucky December tornado. We don't think of tornadoes hitting in December, but there was a devastating tornado several years back that hit Kentucky in the month of December. We always have to be prepared for natural disasters. And really, Mother Nature is just looking at physics, not looking at a calendar. And if we have all those factors involved, like Steve said, if you have drought, if you have wind, if you have people, you're going to be prone to have a wildfire. Thank you so much for listening. Your support has helped the GeoTrek podcast become a top-ranking podcast on the topic of natural disasters. I wanted to also thank our GeoTrek production team, Jeremiah Long, Ashley Anderson, and Braxton Brown. Be sure to leave a review and subscribe to your favorite listening platform to make sure you don't miss any episodes of the GeoTrek podcast in the future. I'm your host, Hurricane Hal, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.